fresh off last night's appearance at the Republican presidential debate in Las Vegas, Donald Trump is in the Valley today for an event in Mesa. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, we'll get a report setting the stage for Trump's speech. We'll also talk about why campaign events, even in non-early primary states, are so important in helping candidates set the mood and generate momentum. Plus, Governor Doug Ducey was profiled recently by the conservative publication The Weekly Standard. Does that indicate that Ducey is starting to be looked at for national office? I'll discuss that with Fred Barnes, who wrote the article about Ducey. Also, it seems like Arizona's job market is seeing steady improvement, but how has 2015 been for the state's overall economy, and what are the continuing challenges as we head into 2016? I'll get insights from economist Jim Rounds. And the newest Star Wars film, The Force Awakens, is generating incomparable buzz. We'll look into what fandom around the movie is like and how it's different from what we've seen before. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first. It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, it seems like Arizona's job market is seeing steady improvement. But how has 2015 been for the state's overall economy? And what are the continuing challenges as we head into 2016? I'll get insights from economist Jim Rounds. Plus, Governor Doug Ducey was profiled recently by the conservative publication The Weekly Standard. Does that indicate that Ducey is starting to be looked at for national office? I'll discuss that with Fred Barnes, who wrote the article about Ducey. And Representative Ann Kirkpatrick is running for the U.S. Senate. She's expected to challenge Senator John McCain in the general election. I'll ask Kirkpatrick about her points of view on foreign policy, including how to fight the self-proclaimed Islamic State. We start today's program with the news that Donald Trump is speaking in moments in Mesa. Last night, Trump was part of the Republican presidential debate in Las Vegas. The debate focused primarily on foreign policy and terrorism. Former Florida Governor Jeb Bush and Trump had a testy exchange over Trump's comments related to banning Muslims from coming to the U.S.
Jeb doesn't really believe I'm unhinged. He said that very simply because he has failed in this campaign. It's been a total disaster. Nobody cares. And frankly, I'm the most solid person up here. I built a tremendous company, and all I want to do is make America great again. I don't want our country to be taken away from us, and that's what's happening. The policies that we've suffered under other presidents have been a disaster for our country. We want to make America great again. And Jeb, in all fairness, he doesn't believe that.
Look, he mentioned me. I can bring it. I can talk to him. This is the problem. Banning all Muslims will make it harder for us to do exactly what we need to do, which is to destroy ISIS.
Donald Trump and Jeb Bush during last night's debate in Las Vegas. Now we turn to KJZZ's Jude Jaffe Block, who's covering Donald Trump's appearance in Mesa today. She joins me now. So, Judy, if you talk to members of the crowd, how did they think that Donald Trump, still considered the national frontrunner, did last night?
Yeah, I'm in a very long line here waiting to get into the venue, and some of my neighbors in line who watched the debate said that they felt like he was being attacked because he's the frontrunner, felt like he did a good job deflecting those and was presidential in the debate. There's a lot of enthusiasm in this line right now.
Yeah. So describe the atmosphere. How many people? I know we don't have an estimate there, but based on what you're seeing, does it seem like a lot of people? And do they seem like they are true, passionate Trump followers? Some have said that people follow Trump because he's a celebrity. Do you get the idea that this is because he's a presidential candidate?
Yeah, I think this event will attract folks of all stripes. I think there will be some counter protesters, some people who are just curious. One of my neighbors in line is a former Democrat who voted for Obama, though, and has come out and decided that she's for Trump. So there's folks of all types here. I think there are a lot of loyal Trump supporters here that are making up a lot of this line, though.
Does this strike you as something special? I mean, does it feel like there's a real buzz?
There's certainly a lot of people here. There's people hawking Trump pins and Trump hats. They were reading Trump quotes as they were selling them. There's sort of a little bit of a rock star feeling, as if we were entering a concert or something. This will be interesting.
So, Jude, Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio is scheduled to introduce Trump before his speech. You have covered the sheriff very closely. What does that indicate about the relationship they have and the message that Trump is bringing?
Yeah, and keep in mind, Sheriff Arpaio introduced Donald Trump last time Trump came to the Valley back in July, and the sheriff mentioned that this candidate was talking about illegal immigration, which is an issue very much associated with our sheriff. So I think the fact that he's introducing him today shows that theme has stayed constant in the Trump campaign, and that that's something that I think a lot of these supporters are interested in hearing about.
Jude Jaffe Block, live with us in Mesa. She's covering Donald Trump's speech today. Jude, thank you.
Thank you.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. That was KJZZ's Jude Jaffe Block joining us from Mesa. And now we're joined by ASU political scientist Rick Herrera to talk about holding events like this in non-early primary states.
It's not unusual for candidates to visit states that are not early primary states or return to states that they've already been to, especially at this point in the campaign. That is, it's early in the campaign. So the candidates are trying to generate some momentum, especially nationally, so that they keep their names in the headlines across the country. Certainly coming to the Phoenix area is going to show up on the headlines on newspapers locally and then nationally. And so with his continued standing in the polls increasing, I think he's even more concerned about maintaining that momentum. So unlike a candidate who's trying to still get some traction, he's got the wherewithal to just sort of try to maintain that momentum in states other than some of the early states. So it's not unusual at all, and it's actually a pretty good campaign strategy.
Delve into this a little bit more for me, this idea that if he has an enthusiastic crowd, is that important as far as perception goes? Is that important as far as real campaigning goes?
Right. It is important for perception because it does suggest, with large crowds, which I'm sure he's anticipating, it suggests that his support is not just limited to certain areas. It's nationwide. He's the candidate of the Republican Party, and it's just a matter of going state to state in those primaries and winning them. It also can keep other candidates who are trying to get traction from taking some of the spotlight. So as well as maintaining his own momentum and his own standing in the polls, he can also prevent other candidates from reaching those same voters, generating some momentum on their own, and then trying to get what he's already got, that is high poll numbers, and for those other candidates, access to increased campaign funds and possibly some endorsements. So, you know, it's much more than just coming to Phoenix and grabbing a headline. It's preventing other candidates from grabbing headlines. And so that's part of the strategy as well. That is, maintaining your momentum is also part of that, is keeping other candidates from gaining momentum. And after a debate, it's possible that polls will reflect some changes. And as a result, he needs to be right on top of that.
How important is his message? We know what his message has been. Is it important for him to just stay on message?
Absolutely, and he's very good at staying on message. You'll note he doesn't apologize for anything that he says. He doesn't usually backtrack anything. He lays it out there, and he sticks by it. And I think that's one of the features of his campaign and of him that his supporters really like. He doesn't back down to any criticism. He doesn't change his message. He stays on it. And his messages, I would say, have been pretty consistent, and they've also been resonating with a lot of Republican voters. And I'll say they've been resonating with a lot of Republican people who identify as Republicans. When we start looking a little bit deeper into Republican registered voters, as well as registered voters who are likely to vote in primary elections, mm-hmm. The support isn't as high as the latest polls would suggest, but it's still fairly high. So he's still ahead of the pack, so to speak. So I think he's a candidate who is very disciplined when it comes to that. I mean, if you look at his campaign, you could say it doesn't look like there's much discipline there because he seems to be all over. But it actually is very disciplined and very focused. I mean, he knows what he's saying, and he knows that he's taking some risk in some cases. But when you've got a lead like he's got, you can take a few risks. And it's all been working for him.
So, Rick, whether it's Donald Trump or Ben Carson or even Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side, do we as observers, member of the media or political scientist, put too much weight in how large a crowd is and how enthusiastic it is because that may or may not translate to votes? Or does that really matter, even if, let's say, Bernie Sanders doesn't win any primaries? Does it show that he has some sort of following, and does that cause maybe his opponents, maybe Senator Clinton or Secretary Clinton, to say, maybe there are some of his ideas I need to adopt?
I think we do put a little bit too much attention as voters and maybe even as observers on the size of campaign crowds. And the reason I say that is because it isn't necessarily indicative of the kind of support they get at the polls. Oftentimes you have people going to see these candidates just because they want to see Donald Trump in person or they want to see Bernie Sanders, but doesn't mean that they're going to turn out to vote. So, for example, Bernie Sanders has been able to get large crowds of fairly young voters, college students and so forth. But we know that the trends are that college students tend not to vote as often as older voters. So it doesn't necessarily translate. So we can place too much emphasis on that, on crowd size as an indicator of actual vote support. On the other hand, it does suggest that the candidate has some following, and for some candidates that means they can then go to potential supporters in terms of people who can support their campaigns with money, that they do have some support out there and that can keep their campaign going. Donald Trump, for example, doesn't suffer from that. Right? He's self-funding. But other candidates, it does matter a lot. And so the perception, again, can matter here. It can matter for other candidates who may want to pick up some campaign messages, but I think less so than we think. In this particular case, if we stay with the Bernie Sanders example, Hillary Clinton has really not moved a whole lot as a result of the Sanders campaign. She may be talking about issues that maybe she wouldn't have emphasized as much as she were he not in the race. But I don't think she's adopting his positions. In fact, she's sort of staked out her ground as being a little bit different than Bernie Sanders. She's not adopting everything he says. So despite the crowds that he's getting, she's not seeming to be affected by that, and that's because her poll numbers are such that she doesn't feel the need to. If it were closer, she might start talking about things a little bit more similarly to Bernie Sanders, but I don't think that's her base anyway, and I don't think she's worried too much about those younger voters flocking to another candidate after she gets the nomination.
Finally, Rick, do you think we'll see more candidates coming to Arizona as we ramp up? Obviously, the Iowa caucus is next month. Then that could build momentum for them? Or are we sort of reaching the stage that once the caucuses and the primaries start, there isn't time for events like this?
Well, I think that's true. I mean, once the caucuses and the primaries start, it's a much shorter time frame. You're heading into some of the coastal east coastal states and then the southern primary. So there's going to be less time to spend in those other caucus and primary states. But you will see some candidates. And I think to the extent that some candidates can stay alive through those early states, you might begin to see Arizona and some other later primary states take on greater relevance. They're already, some of the Republican operatives are talking about, well, we're not sure that we're going to have an emerged actual nominee by the time we get to the convention. So that places more importance on the later primaries and gathering up of delegates. In many states, it's a winner-take-all situation in the Republican primaries. And so it matters if you can come in first in a 5 or 6 person, which I'm anticipating that's what it's going to be at that point, race in some of these later states. And so and Arizona's, it's kind of in one of those middle states. That is, it has a sizable number of delegates, both on Democratic and Republican Party sides. So it can make a difference. Same thing with Nevada. Same thing with a number of the western states and Colorado, for example.
Political scientist Richard Herrera is an associate professor in the School of Politics and Global Studies at ASU. Rick, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk foreign policy with Arizona Congresswoman Ann Kirkpatrick. And then later on this hour, what's the job market in the Valley looking like and in the state of Arizona as we enter 2016? Stay with us.
KJZZ is supported by Smart Document Solutions, a Xerox-authorized sales agent locally owned since 1988. Office equipment and fleet management needs with access to the entire portfolio of Xerox document solutions. AZSmartOffice.com.
Good morning. It's Here and Now on KJZZ. Be with us today at 1 for BBC NewsHour. Taking a look at Valley traffic right now, westbound on the I-10, the shoulder is blocked by an accident at Litchfield Road. Westbound on the US 60 freeway, there's a report of an object in the roadway at Ellsworth Road. Around the state right now, 42 degrees in Tucson, 57 in Yuma, 30 degrees in Prescott. It's a balmy 27 in Flagstaff. If you've got an unwanted car in your driveway, there's still time to donate it to KJZZ and get a 2015 tax deduction. Just donate it before December 31st. We'll tow it away for free and we'll turn your car into the programs you love. To donate a vehicle, go to cars.kjzz.org and thanks. Sunny skies, 46% relative humidity, and it's 48 degrees in Phoenix at 11:21.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Senator John McCain is facing primary opposition in his 2016 re-election bid, but most analysts are looking more closely at who McCain will likely face in the general election next year. U.S. Representative Ann Kirkpatrick of Arizona's 1st District, and she joins me now to talk about a few current events. We've heard about a budget being agreed to by Republican legislative leaders. Can you give us your general thoughts about it?
Oh, I just heard that myself, Stephen, and I think that's great. We're hoping to wrap up our business here by the end of the week and come home for the holidays.
Let's talk about some foreign issues, some foreign policy issues, mostly related to the self-proclaimed Islamic State. Now, thanks to the attacks in Paris, also the killings in San Bernardino, do you have thoughts about what U.S. policy should be in fighting ISIL or ISIS? What do you think about the job the president's doing? And are there certain modifications you think should be made?
Well, ISIS is the greatest threat our nation faces today, and it's not only abroad, but unfortunately, as we saw last week here at home with what we just saw happen in San Bernardino. And no, I don't think the president's strategy is working. I think we need to do a better job. We need a strong, comprehensive strategy that involves the president and Congress. And I'll just give you an example. I mean, we need to take up and debate and pass the authorization for the use of military force. So the authorization we're using now is outdated. And we need to do that as members of Congress and bring that to the floor for debate so the American people's voices can be heard.
Do you think this is a situation that needs to involve as many countries as possible with the U.S. as leader, or should the U.S. be willing to, in some cases, go it alone if need be?
Well, I think that we do need to work with our allies. I mean, look, we've got the most powerful military and intelligence capabilities in the world, and we need to use them whenever necessary to keep our nation safe. But in the end, I mean, we have to destroy ISIS and do everything in our power to protect the American people.
Do you think the president's message is significant in terms of the public? He got some criticism for the speech he made recently, and people were sort of saying, well, he seems to understand the problem, but he didn't sort of say it in a way that necessarily made the American people feel secure. Do you think that is as important, or at least important in its own way, as it is actually fighting ISIS?
Well, I think that people feel like that, you know, that ISIS is the greatest threat to our nation. We have to be strong, and we have to do everything in our power to protect the American people. ISIS has to be destroyed.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with Representative Ann Kirkpatrick, who joins us from Washington. Representative, the U.S. economy has been in recovery mode for a few years, but there are still a lot of Americans who feel underemployed, uncertain about the future. From your perspective, what can and should government be doing to improve that? Are there certain policies you'd advocate?
Yeah, you know, I travel all over Arizona. I'm listening to folks. And look, people are still struggling. It's tough out there. And that's one of the reasons I'm running for the Senate. I mean, I'm fighting to give Arizona families a chance to succeed by creating jobs. My vision for Arizona is a strong, diverse, stable economy. And that includes supporting small businesses, but also, you know, improving our access to quality education. We've seen education really take some hits recently, and we've got to turn that around. But I'm also talking with veterans to make sure they get the benefits they've earned, and in, you know, giving folks from all walks of life a stake in our state's future. That's why I'm running.
And there are some people who are afraid that this is kind of the new normal right now, with more people working part-time and that sort of thing. Do you buy that, or you think it can get better?
Oh, it definitely can get better. I mean, again, my vision for Arizona is a strong, diversified, stable economy. I've seen Arizona go through too many boom and bust cycles in my lifetime. You know, I grew up in a small timber town up in the White Mountains, and we're trying to bring back the timber industry, but ranching, farming, biotech, bioscience, universities, education, all that is part of that economic outlook, and it's bright for Arizona. We have a bright future.
Now, for some Americans, the Affordable Care Act has been a boon. For some, it's been really frustrating, and Republican members of Congress keep pushing to overturn it, even with the Supreme Court affirming its constitutionality. Do you think improvements still need to be made, though, in how Americans get health care?
I've always said that we need to improve the Affordable Care Act. I spent years as a hospital attorney up in Flagstaff, and look, it's not perfect. We've got to improve our healthcare system, and I will work with my colleagues across the aisle to do that.
Now, do you think it's important when you move from potentially moving from the House to the Senate? Obviously, one would say, well, there are 435 members of the House, 100 in the Senate. But do you think that in and of itself will allow you to have a larger impact if you were to become the next U.S. senator from Arizona? Or is there something else that goes into being a good senator compared to being a good representative?
Well, definitely. You know, I look forward to that opportunity to work on behalf of the good people in Arizona and my colleagues in the House. So, you know, every legislation has to have a House sponsor and a Senate sponsor. I want to be that go-to person for my colleagues in the House so we can get things done for Arizona.
Now, Senator McCain, who would potentially be your opponent in the general election if all goes as many people expect, he's been or had been one of the leaders on comprehensive immigration reform as a member of the so-called Gang of Eight. Where do you stand on immigration reform? Is comprehensive reform possible?
Comprehensive immigration reform is necessary. I mean, it's one of the reasons I first ran for the House of Representatives. I was frustrated in the legislature at the piecemeal efforts to address that. And again, it goes back to building that strong, diverse, stable economy. Comprehensive immigration reform is the next step in getting there. So we've got to get it done.
Last thing for you, is there anything that that we haven't discussed that you think that there's something that really is important to you that you think is vitally important to Arizona? It doesn't get talked about enough, and that there may be some specific things you think should be done.
Yeah, you know, I'm really concerned about the terror gap. You know, anyone too dangerous to fly is too dangerous to buy weapons. I mean, it comes back to, again, we've got to make sure that our American people are safe.
U.S. Representative Ann Kirkpatrick of Arizona's 1st District. She's also a U.S. Senate candidate. Representative, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And we're also making plans to have other candidates in the U.S. Senate race join us on Here and Now, including Senator John McCain. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Arizona's economy has bounced back, but there's still a significant level of dissatisfaction with where we're at. So where do we really stand? What has improved over the course of 2015? And is there momentum for a strong 2016? With me to talk about that is economist Jim Rounds, president of Rounds Consulting Group. Jim, welcome back.
Thank you.
So what were you anticipating when 2015 started as far as the state's economy? What has gotten stronger and what has still stayed a little bit tepid?
Well, we knew that this was going to be a tough expansion, and we knew that it was going to take a while before we recovered all those lost jobs because we lost so many when we went through that downturn. Things materialized a little bit more slowly than anticipated. We knew it would be around mid-decade, but now we're looking around 2016 for full job recovery. Job growth in terms of rates in the Phoenix area between 2.5% and 3%, that's not bad. It's not what we would normally see during an expansion or a boom period, but it's okay. But there's other parts of the state, like Tucson, that are growing at 1%. So it's a have and have nots type of situation.
You know, obviously, jobs are the most important thing at the core of our existence as people. And I mean, I don't want to down or dismiss that in any sense. But as far as the overall economy goes, is it, if the job market were a little bit better, would you feel great about this market? Would you feel great about this economy right now? And also, what are some of the obvious offshoots of having a good job market?
So that's a good question, because people have been counting jobs, but we also have to count quality jobs. And this recovery has been about modest wage growth, modest job creation. So it's kind of it's positive, but it's not all that great. And so it's great that we're adding jobs in retail areas, tourism and hospitality, one of our base sector industries, but they don't pay as highly. Yeah. We're still very much down in terms of manufacturing, and we've done a bad job of getting into some of those new sectors where they'll create the higher value added jobs over the next 4 or 5 years. So we still have some problems, even though we're a top 10, 15 state in terms of job growth.
So what are we missing? There's always talk about what goes on at the Capitol, and sometimes I think that's overdone, even to someone who follows that as obsessively as I do.
Yeah.
Are there other things that need to be happening? Are there business leaders that need to step up? What's missing right now?
So the state took it on the chin when we went through the recession. It got the business community to get together with the policymakers much more. So I see them talking all the time. The economic development groups are getting together, but there's only so much that you can do in terms of policy to change the economy. We're very much dependent on what happens nationally. And so that'll continue to dampen our recovery, regardless of what we do. But there are some things that we can focus on. So we've implemented tax policy changes, economic development policy. We're at the point where I think we can tweak those, where I think we have to focus on a little bit more. And it wasn't as of interest before because people felt like it would take too long. But this growing from within concept, I would love to see more policy where it focuses on small businesses, because that small business becomes the next big business that pays high wages down the road, and we don't have to spend $10 million to recruit them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's talk about that, because for a long time, I'm sure people have heard you on this program and other places on KJZZ before, and they know you as the senior economist for another firm, and now you have your own firm. What are some of the things you went through in creating that? I mean, one would think that as an economist, you would have fewer issues than some of us would in starting a business, but you had some challenges.
Yeah, this was a great case study, and this is what I do for a living, and I thought this will be a piece of cake forming a corporation. And the two things that I will remember the most, and I'll remember these, you know, forever, is dealing with the ACC, the Arizona Corporation Commission. They have a great setup. They're very helpful for business organization, and I was very impressed. They have to be one of the top in the country in terms of being setting up policies that are conducive to getting this stuff done quickly. Dealing with the banks, much different story. And I won't say which bank, but the bank that I have personally banked with for 25 years, when I was in there talking about lines of credit, setting up the business stuff, it was as if I walked in off the street. So when I see that van go by and it's Joe's Plumbing, I have a better appreciation for what he went through. And that's just one extreme. But what that showed me is that there are a lot of hurdles that small businesses have to go through. And that's not even with ones that have a lot of technology and equipment and all that other stuff. Mm-hmm. I think that's an area where we can have some good policy change over the next couple of years.
Let's talk a little bit about small business, because this has come up with so many people who run for elective office. They hear, well, you know, small business is the heart of the American economy. And okay, most of us believe that, but why is that? Why is a good foundation for small business going to make a bigger difference than having corporations, for example?
So you have two different types of small businesses. We need to have the higher wage businesses, and oftentimes they're the bigger companies, create the business activity that creates the demand for the small business. So you have an Intel creating the demand for the copy place, creating demand for the dry cleaners, retail, whatever it may be. But then you have this interesting small business aspect that operate like a base industry. They could locate anywhere. They need a place where they can get some financing, where they can get things started up. And again, those are the businesses that after several years become the economic drivers for the state. And here's why I think policymakers need to think long-term on both. As many ribbon-cutting ceremonies as we've seen where 200 new workers come in, do you think I would ever change an economic forecast when I see one of those? No. I would only change it if they did it well over about 10 years. If it's going to take a long time anyways, then why don't we talk about small business? Why don't we talk about workforce development and talk about education like we've been seeing down at the state capitol the last 6 months as well?
Mm-hmm. It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix talking with economist Jim Rounds. He's president of Rounds Consulting Group. So education is huge in terms of bringing in new businesses, but as you talk about growing from within as well, how vital is it in overall these sectors?
I think we need to do both, and this applies everywhere, but I think this is critically important in developing those high-wage sectors, because Arizona used to be one of the poster childs for having a high manufacturing employment base, and within that manufacturing employment base, it was all high-tech stuff. Arizona wasn't one of those states where we lost the Motorola when we saw downsizing in semiconductors that was able to fill that gap. We have to do that better, but you can't do it overnight. And that's why I think people need to talk about it, continue talking about it, because it takes many, many years to change the dynamics of a large economy.
So are people just saying this, though? Because it seems like more people are on the same page and saying that, you know, K-12 is very important, whether it's just increasing funding or increasing funding and coming up with new standards, whatever it is. Do you get the feeling that people are taking this more seriously, legitimately?
Yeah, I do. And I've seen this on both sides of the aisle. And I had a chance to talk in an education conference recently. And the whole discussion wasn't politically based. It was more of an economic discussion. Mm-hmm. It was, we can spend a little bit more on education, but let's figure out where we can spend monies, where we get a return on investment. And I think that's where the two sides don't always come together, because you might hear one side say, well, we need a certain amount of money. And, you know, usually you have a B after the number, like $1 billion. Then another side that says, well, you really don't increase performance with extra spending. There's truth on both of those sides, and I think we need to come to some kind of a meeting in the middle. And one thing that I did like to see is that even though we are talking about, you know, trust land issues and things like that to fund education, they're talking about funding it in some way, and they're starting to be strategic. But we're not landing somebody on the moon, I think I've said before. We're trying to figure out how to fund a government agency or even spinoff like with charter schools. We can figure this out. We just need people to be a little kinder to one another in some of these political meetings.
Now, Arizona's become sort of the haven for tax cuts. And with Governor Ducey in office, he has talked about wanting to cut taxes every year. And there's a real dividing line on this one, whether the state has already cut taxes too much, and that is one of the reasons perhaps for the shortfall in education. There are other people who still believe that is a driving force in growing an economy. Is that also something in the middle?
Yeah, and it's really, they got to get away from the discussion of tax cuts or tax increases. It's, what's the tax system that's going to be conducive to growing the big businesses, the small businesses that we were talking about? And this is where I think they can make some tweaks. And so there's been a lot of interest in trying to figure out how income tax policy impacts business development, and that'll impact small businesses disproportionately. They might be able to modify things. But all this discussion has to happen in the context of, can we have a balanced budget longer term? And our economy, the expansion, is getting long in the tooth. And expansions don't just die for no reason. Mm-hmm. But after the next 2 or 3 years, the likelihood of having a recession will go up. By the end of the decade, we will very likely have a downturn. But we can plan for it now. What happened last time? We just felt really great about ourselves. We could never be harmed. And we had one of the worst recessions in our history. So let's maybe plan a little bit better this time, and then we can be strategic with these things. But if you just hear about them talking about tax cuts or tax increases and they're not talking intelligently, then we're probably not going to see much progress.
Well, yeah, you and I have talked about how this is not really a black and white issue, but tax cuts come up a lot. In general, do you think that Governor Ducey talking about this as often as he does is a good idea, or does it sound more like he's trying to appease a certain level of politicians, a certain level of the public?
I'm all for people bringing up ideas that could be talked about. And like you said, the truth is somewhere in between usually. But here's one thing that I'm going to look for in the state of the state and what the legislature says. Are they going to be talking about more of a system that's going to be more competitive? So if they want to tweak tax policy, that's fine. I'd want to see that it's intelligently crafted. I want to see if they're going to be hitting regulatory issues. I want to see if they're going to have some small business development, workforce training, ways of continuing to address education funding, even though we've already done that a little bit. It has to be a package, because no one thing is going to change the economy. But if we have the right package put together and we continue to have intelligent discussions over several years, government actually can improve the economy some.
Jim, finally, let's talk a little bit about tourism. That's been something you've talked about a lot over the years.
Yes.
Where's the state at in terms of bouncing back from tourism? Do you think we spend enough on tourism, too much? Where are you at?
Tourism and hospitality employment has fully recovered and is doing quite well. And so some people have lost a little bit of interest in talking about tourism as a component of the economy. But my answer is, but where would we be if we had a little more support? And I'm all for spending more on tourism, because I'm convinced that you at least get $1 back for each dollar you spend. You hear the experts say, well, it's a 7-to-1 return or a 3-to-1 return. If you get a dollar back for each dollar you spend, you break even. Usually people say, well, I at least believe that. I think we can do a little bit more, but I love what they're trying to do with blending tourism and business development. So this kind of combination of economic development, including tourism and business promotion and marketing the state, that's what we've been talking about that for several years, and it's actually happening down at the Capitol right now. So there are some bright spots, but we should still keep our eye on them.
Economist Jim Rounds is president of the Rounds Consulting Group. Jim, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And still to come on Here and Now, we'll find out why a national conservative publication is profiling Governor Doug Ducey and The Force Awakens. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by the West Valley Symphony, joined by the Stardust Youth Ensemble from TheaterWorks for a program of seasonal fun at the Performing Arts Center in Surprise this Sunday. westvalleysymphony.org.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM and streaming at kjzz.org. Well, to the Valley freeways right now, I-10 westbound, there's a crash blocking the Litchfield Road on-ramp. Eastbound on the 10, be on the lookout for a collision on the shoulder at 16th Street. Well, it's going to be sunny today in the Valley, but bring a sweater or a jacket if you're going to be outside. We're expecting a high of just 55 degrees. That's 12 degrees below normal for this day. About the same tomorrow, a little bit warmer with a high of 58, and we should be back into the mid to upper 60s by Friday. NPR's Here and Now is coming up at 12 today. Stocks around the world were up this morning ahead of the Fed's expected announcement raising interest rates. We'll get the latest on that. And a view of the state of the economy from an aisle of the grocery store. Here and Now from Boston starts at noon. Sunny skies, 48 degrees right now in Phoenix at 11:41.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Governor Doug Ducey has been in office for less than a year, but he's already become quite popular among Republicans around the country. He's been invited to spend time with the Koch brothers, the Republican Governors Association has said glowing things about him, and now the conservative Weekly Standard publication has profiled Ducey. The writer of that profile is Weekly Standard executive editor Fred Barnes, who's also co-author of the recently published book about the late Congressman Jack Kemp. It's called Jack Kemp, the Bleeding Heart Conservative Who Changed America. And Fred Barnes joins me now. So the title of the article refers to Governor Doug Ducey as the consummate happy warrior, and that seems to put him in the company of people like Jack Kemp, who you just wrote a book about, and Ronald Reagan. It's even been applied to Vice President Joe Biden. From what you saw of Governor Ducey, why does that phrase ring true?
I'd seen him first during the campaign last year. He came by my office on two separate occasions when he was in Washington. I'd never met him before. And he was obviously running for governor of Arizona, and I assume he was in Washington to get money, among other things, and political support. And he just seemed like quite a happy guy. Most people running for office are weighted down by the concerns. And this is when he had a primary first, and then, of course, the general election. So he struck me as a very pretty joyful guy then. And the same thing when I interviewed him when I was in Arizona several weeks ago, when I was actually doing a couple of book events, one in Phoenix and one in Tucson, and arranged ahead of time to interview Governor Ducey at his office. And same guy I'd seen before.
Do you think that eventually can make someone more effective? Because as you said, most people seem weighed down. And from those of us who are on the outside, we look at a lot of the politicians and elected officials, and they seem like the weight of the world is on them. Maybe it is to some extent, but they also don't seem to even enjoy the process that much.
I think you're right on both counts. Many of them don't enjoy the process, and many of them do feel like the weight of the world is on their shoulders, and sometimes it is. In truth, if you're running for office, people don't like some guy who goes around as if the weight of the world is on his shoulders. And they like politicians who seem to be able to take their job seriously, but not themselves too seriously. And that was certainly true about Ronald Reagan. Jack Kemp was such an intense guy and yet made people happy when he would speak. This is an insight of Newt Gingrich that he had about Kemp, and he was a Kemp acolyte and would travel with Kemp and see the reaction of audiences when Kemp would speak. I haven't seen the Governor Ducey in front of an audience, but in front of me, I found it appealing that he wasn't weighted down. And obviously, he's done some things, some well, and he's ambitious to do more as governor. But didn't seem to be the only thing on his mind. He also talked at some length about meeting the Pope.
Right. which he seemed to be excited about. So let me come back to Ducey as a potential politician. I know it's early in the game. He was Arizona State Treasurer, but it's only been governor for less than a year. Based on what you know about his policy goals and even what he thinks about education and some other issues, does that line up with what other Republicans and conservatives are saying around the country, what they're interested in accomplishing? Does it seem consistent, or does he seem like he has a little bit of his own path?
I think he has a little bit of his own path. One of the things he talked about, and others who I talked to about him said the same thing, that his big goal is to really narrow the gap in achievement between the schools in Arizona, the schools in poor neighborhoods and minority neighborhoods where the kids don't do as well. The schools probably aren't as good, and those in more affluent neighborhoods. And he wants to narrow that gap by bringing, by improving the schools and the achievements of the students in the schools that aren't doing as well. That's not something much conservatives talk about nationally. Most of them now are spending all their time condemning Common Core, and they really don't talk about this. I found it refreshing that here at the state level, Governor Ducey had a goal that was really state related that he was intense about, and it wasn't something that would lift him to the presidency, for instance.
Arizona is a state that generally, but definitely in the last couple of election cycles, has really become very conservative, very Republican. Statewide offices are all held by Republicans. And yet there is still that one portion of naysayers when it comes to Governor Ducey. And one thing that does come up is the idea of what to do about tax policy, because he's been someone who, rather than talk more about tax reform, he has talked about potentially at some point eliminating the state income tax. And there are people here who say, well, you know, that's a great goal, except what happens when you eliminate the income tax and then we don't have enough to pay for services and programs? Is that unique to him, or is that a policy you're seeing as well from other Republican governors?
Well, now that is a policy you see from Republican governors and who talk about gradually eliminating state income taxes and talk less, of course, about what they're going to replace it with. Obviously, they would like to cut spending a little bit, but not so much that it would replace elimination of the state income tax. So that, I think he's echoing a lot of different governors, Republican governors around the country, in saying that. And most of them don't achieve it. What they do is they reduce taxes, particularly the state income tax, in very small steps.
And that's, again, one issue where he's had some fight from the other side, but also he did get some credit. You mentioned this in your piece as well about bringing the other sides, the opposite sides, to the table when it came to settling this K-12 education lawsuit. Do you think a happy warrior in politics needs to be able to work across the aisle when needed? Because we're hearing more from those of us who are outside the Beltway about this feeling that there's too much of A is good, B is bad, as opposed to, okay, we can have a little bit of B and a little bit of A. How do you think that works as far as working across the aisle for someone like Governor Ducey or someone who has aspirations for higher office?
Now, here you're really on to something, because I think it's important. If you're going to be all the happy warriors I've known, whether it was Ronald Reagan or whether it was Jack Kemp or others, or Governor Ducey, they did work across the aisle. They realized the importance of things. Now we have, I mean, look at Washington now, and you see the sides are divided and between Republicans in Congress and President Obama, and they don't even talk to each other. It is a part, I think, if you want to be a politician who achieves things, you have to be somebody who works with the other side. I mean, look what Reagan did. He had to work with a very heavily Democratic House of Representatives that ultimately, not all of them, but a chunk of them voted for his tax cuts, and then a lot more of them voted for his tax reform plan in 1986 that was really, had been hatched in the first place by a couple of Democrats, Bill Bradley and Dick Gephardt. And Kemp, Jack Kemp, always wanted Democrats on his side for whatever his policies were, whether it was HUD secretary or seeking deep tax cuts. It was essential to him. And I think if Doug Ducey follows that, he'll be in good company.
One final question for you, Mr. Barnes. When it comes to Doug Ducey, again, like I said, just he's only been governor for about a year or so. Is he someone who's seen potentially as an up-and-comer, someone who could be on the national stage for the Republican Party?
Well, I have to say it didn't occur to me when I was talking to him. But now that we've mentioned it, he does have some traits that I think would be very good. But, you know, governors in their first year, I think they have a little more proving to do. He's off to a good start, obviously, with that education agreement. I think it's unusual for a Republican to have the education establishment even on his side when you do education reform and settle the lawsuit and so on. that's a quite an achievement. But let's see what's next. I wouldn't throw him out there as a presidential possibility. You know, I mean, writing about politics, I know I've done it and others have done it. We get we jump on things before they're ready. And, I think it'd be premature to think about it that way.
Fred Barnes, executive editor of the Weekly Standard. He recently wrote a profile of Arizona Governor Doug Ducey. He's also the co-author of the recently published book, Jack Kemp, the Bleeding Heart Conservative Who Changed America. Mr. Barnes, thanks.
I enjoyed it.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The latest Star Wars film, The Force Awakens, is opening later this week to an incomparable level of anticipation, hype, and goodwill. I was one of those little kids who stood in line to see the original Star Wars, but I haven't been a passionate follower in more recent years. But the marketing on The Force Awakens has fueled a passion among people who aren't considered traditional Star Wars fans. To talk about that and more is Bob Beard of the Center for Science and the Imagination at ASU. He's also the founder of the PBS Nerdwalk. Bob, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks very much.
So let's start with Star Wars. What do you make of this sort of unique infrastructure, this multimedia marketing that has sort of made people who really haven't been fans for decades like me sort of consider it seems multi-generational to me.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So I think Star Wars is this incredible cultural referent, right? Like everybody knows it, even if you didn't see any of the movies. I mean, I can pick up the stapler over here and go vroom, vroom, and you know what I'm doing, right? So what Star Wars has is it has this superstructure, right? This transmedia superstructure that's rhizomic, that you don't need to be a part of that original canon. You don't need to know the Skywalker story, the Skywalker legacy to be a Star Wars fan. There's kids playing with toys who have never seen the movies. There's games and books only about one element of the universe. And then in digital communication with Twitter and whatnot, I can have a conversation using just Darth Vader memes, and I'm still engaging in a cultural production of Star Wars without actually viewing the movies. So it's a new world.
Maybe some of our listeners would disagree, but I think based on when you talk about something like this, when there are marketing campaigns for things, like you see a particular character on, let's say, whatever product it may be, a lot of people shake their heads. For some reason, with Star Wars, it doesn't quite feel that way. It sort of feels okay.
Yeah, I mean, the fandom for Star Wars is the engine that runs it, right? Like, I like to think of fandom on an X, Y, and Z axis. Like, you have the X axis, which is the canon, which is the media that is made. And then you have the Y axis, which is the licensing and the merchandising. And then you have the Z axis, and that's fits in everything else. That's the fandom, and that's what negotiates all these distributed parts. And that's what also gives real-world context to all these disparate elements. But also, because fandom relies on time and energy and resources, and that's so much of what fandom is, somebody inevitably is going to monetize it, right? Like, somebody is going to make Darth Vader salad tongs because they want to be a part of that movement, which I think fandom's at a really interesting point right now, because there was a time, and you still see it a little bit in media narratives, that you see somebody dressed up as a stormtrooper, and it's like, what's that weirdo doing? But what you don't understand, or what I think, you know, your listeners might be interested to understand, is that there is a lot of important work going on in that fandom. It's connected learning, and it's driven by that passion and that imagination of that world.
It's funny that you mentioned that people might laugh at someone dressed like that, because it actually feels to me more like, whether it's cosplay or whether we're hearing more about Comic-Con and this sort of thing, it does feel like the narrative is being pushed more by folks who say, you know, I have other things in my life, but I'm really passionate about this. And you've probably got some hidden passion, too. Why not let it out? Why not be an authentic fan?
Yeah. And I think also with fandom is that, and especially in terms of Star Wars, which is this rich intertextual universe, you can overlay whatever your fandom is or whatever your experience is into that universe, and it's accessible. There's a blog run by a patent lawyer, and he actually does legal briefs about the Star Wars universe, and he applies his real-world expertise into this thing that he loves, which is just amazing. I mean, he's talking about Han shooting first is actually considered like a stand your ground legal argument. So it is legal self-defense. Han Solo is justified.
Where does fandom play into our identities as individuals?
That's a great question. like I said, everybody's a fan for something. And what you can do is you're creating and sort of remixing and understanding your identity in terms of this thing that you love. And when it gets back to connected learning, I mean, you're really creating a voice and a representation for yourself. And I think also there's an element of self-efficacy, right? So not only are you driven by your innate curiosity, but in fan communities, you're supported by others in that realm, people that are experts, people that are fellow practitioners. There's a shared purpose because you're contributing to the universe, but you're actually making something real. I mean, you might be making a stormtrooper helmet, but you're producing something and you're making it and you're innovating and you're iterating and you're learning from others while you're doing this, you know, amazing work.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. A few more minutes up with Bob Beard of ASU's Center for Science and the Imagination at ASU. We're talking about fandom. We're also talking a little bit about The Force Awakens. Now, Bob, I came to you because the Center for Science and the Imagination seemed to be a good fit for that. I mean, are these on parallel paths as far as what you guys look into?
Oh, absolutely. So the center serves as a space between humanities and the science to provide collaboration between artists and engineers and the public to engage in big questions about science and the future. And so we celebrate this, especially these big, grand science fiction epics like this Force Awakens, and we're inspired by that collective imagination surrounding them. It's a great space for learning and to facilitate a dialogue between all the constituents because we're all going into the future together. Let's build it together.
Well, Star Wars was initially, when the film came out in the mid to late 70s, it was talking about how it was sort of like a Western in space. And so that sort of crosses this idea of culture and literary and even fandom now as well. How important is it for any of these films or any of these TV shows to have a great plot and great characters in addition to just having people get excited about it? I mean, does it have to be a quality product?
I think the product will engender the fandom. So if it's a subpar product, it's not authentic. I mean, I look at the other movies that came out on the heels of Star Wars. Let me name one: Ice Pirates. If anybody remembers Ice Pirates, probably call into the show. But it's one of those there was a glut of knockoffs, and they weren't authentic, and they didn't come from the place. They were just a cash grab. Mm-hmm. And so I think the fandom is savvy enough to identify the things that are purposeful and that are authentic, and that they can operate within.
All right, take us inside the head of Bob Beard for a second, even if it's a scary place. I hope it's not. But what are you really passionate about as a fan when it comes to entertainment, when it comes to sci-fi, whatever it may be?
I kind of miss the boat on Star Wars a little bit. Like, I'm really into it now because my kids are into it, and so I'm seeing it through their eyes, which is amazing. So, yes, I get it. Like, I'm a convert. But because I missed out on Star Wars, right after that, it was Indiana Jones. So huge Indiana Jones fan and huge Ghostbusters fan. I've gone so far as to build my own proton pack, which is a little obsessive, and it scared off my wife when we were newly married. You're going to do what?
So are you excited about the all-female Ghostbusters, or you don't want the tradition touched?
Oh, no. Okay. I am not a gatekeeper for any of that. If it's media that I love, I just want more of it. And whoever's performing it, fantastic. Great by me.
Bob, finally, are you going to go see The Force Awakens in the theater?
Saturday morning with my kids.
Okay. Now, you had to say with your kids. Would you have been okay just saying, I'm going to go see it?
Yeah.
would you want to see it without your kids or no?
You know, that opportunity actually came up, and it's a communal experience, and it's a family experience, and I want to be there with my kids to, again, see it through their eyes. So, I gave up my tickets on Thursday night to see an early showing so I can go see it with my kids on Saturday morning.
Great, okay. Bob Beard of the Center for Science and the Imagination at ASU is also one of the founders of the PBS NerdWalk. Bob, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks very much to Sarah Ventry, our senior producer, for her help on today's program. Thanks also to Bruce Drummond, and thank you very much for listening. If you missed any part of the program, you can download the free KJZZ app to your smartphone. You can also go online later this afternoon to kjzz.org. Stay with us for NPR's Here and Now. It's next on member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. Hope you have a great rest of the day. It's 12 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by Subaru Superstore of Chandler, a local family-owned and operated dealership, celebrating the 8th annual Subaru Share the Love event, which has contributed more than $65 million to charity. Shop Subaru.com.